Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2016. Lecture 19, delivered on March 30, 2016. The title of this lecture is Risk.
Today, risk. As I had mentioned on several occasions, we really don't want to talk about return without bringing in risk, which is the other dimension that is always associated with risks that you take, with returns that you expect, I should say. And I will go into risk at the end. I will introduce the capital asset pricing model and then flesh it out next week in the following chapter. But for right now, I have brought up the average annual return, which is sometimes designated as R with a bar over it, and also the standard deviation of returns, which is the square root of the variance and a pain to calculate by hand, even with a calculator. And I encourage you to either use Excel or if you have a decent scientific calculator. But I do want to make sure I emphasize that when you calculate the variance, you use the calculator's key for samples, which would divide that mess of squares, the sum of squares, by n minus 1, not by n. Otherwise, you'd be off a little bit. I also introduced you to the annualized return, which was the ending price when you sold over the beginning price to the one over the number of years that you held the portfolio. I showed you a place where you can get the number of days and then between two dates and then divide that by 365.25 minus 1. There's one other one that I hadn't shown you yet, and the book brings this one up. It's called the realized annualized return. Now, the realized annual... The book calls it the annual realized return. It's a little bit of an oddball in the sense that what you do is you, I don't know if I want to bring that up too much, but it's 1 plus the return from the first year times 1 plus the return from the second year on through to 1 plus the return from the nth year, and then minus 1. I don't want to get into that one too much. It's an important one later. It's related to what's called the Fisher formula. But here are all these ways that you can measure. Return and risk. These two are popular as sort of a quick method of finding your return and your risk. The standard deviation, if this prices, stock prices are distributed normally, the R bar tells you the center of the distribution, the center of what you should expect, of what happened, I should say. The splatter of the normal is measured by the standard deviation. So in other words, this would be a much higher risk set of returns on this guy, because it's just, they're all over the place. This one would be a tighter set of returns. It's more compact. So your 67% confidence level is much narrower than it is with this widely splattered one. I want to bring up one more that is important in other finance classes. It's also important in management, some management science classes, and used to teach it in this class under other books, but it's a very important one, and you might have seen it in a stats course. It's called the coefficient of variation. It's a measure of risk, and it's quite important when you're analyzing corporate financial statements, especially when you want to compare two financial statements of companies that have very different scales of numbers. I could have two companies in the same industry, but their numbers, one company has numbers that are in the hundreds of thousands, maybe millions. The other company might have numbers in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And I'm talking about costs, revenue, profit, what have you. So comparing their standard deviations, their risks and all, their expected returns and all that kind of stuff, or the center of the distribution, how can I say, okay, I'm looking at the costs, let me say this one. I'm looking at the net profits for a giant company, and the expected return might be 400 million in profit, net profit, net income. And then I want to compare that to a company that is considerably smaller. Kill it with fire. Okay. So, and let's say that this company's center of its cost, of its net income, is 20 million. To try to compare those costs and the standard deviations, especially the standard deviation, the spread of the risk between those two companies, I can't do it because their numbers are so much different. But there is a way to do it, and it's a great thing to keep in your little portfolio of formulas. The coefficient of variation, CV, is the standard deviation scaled by the expected value that R bar for returns is R bar. It's just the average. In other words, when you take the standard deviation and divide it by the expected value of it, you turn them all of the numbers of different companies into the same essential metric. You compare apples to apples. Now I bring that up here, this coefficient of variation. It has a really nice application when you look at something. I was checking the numbers in the textbook. They're off because the book's about a year and a half out of date now. But I'll just use those numbers that are in the book so that you can get the comparison yourself. Here are the numbers for the expected return, or rather for the average return, annual return, for small stocks. The average return is 18.74% with a standard deviation of 38.97%. The expected return, this is for S&P 500 companies. 11.70% expected return with a standard deviation of 20%, okay? And then here are corporate bonds. Their expected return is 6.58% with a standard deviation of 6.98%. Here's the deal, though. Here's the deal. You can say right off the bat, well, I see higher return, higher volatility of returns for small stocks, 18.74, 38.97. As opposed to somewhat safer stocks in the Standard & Poor's 500, larger companies, 11.70% with a lower 20.20% standard deviation, volatility. And for corporate bonds, as I've told you on several occasions, which are very safe, very quiet instruments, you have an expected return of 6.58% with a standard deviation of 6.98%. So you see the relationship, and you would want to immediately say, I see the risk-return relationship. I see it. But that's really not what you should be looking at, because these returns are higher, that expected value is higher, that probably is associated with a bigger, mathematically, a larger standard deviation. So let me do the coefficient of variation for each of these. And I held this one off until we had the chance to be in class together, because I'm actually a little curious about this one myself. I did this calculation a few years back, and I haven't done it since then. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the CV. This is the average return. Average return. This is the standard deviation of those returns. Now let's look at the coefficient of variation of the returns. We should still, I hope, see the risk-return relationship, but maybe not. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take 38.97 divided by 18.74. 38.97 divided by 18.74. And I get a coefficient of variation of 2.08. Now I'm going to take the next one, 20.2, divide that by 11.7, and I get 1.73. And then I'm going to take the last one, which is 6.98, divided by 6.58, and I get 1.06. There is the risk-return relationship. Apples to apples. You see, a higher average return, but mathematically would have a bigger standard deviation. Just think about the formula. The average R bar is in the standard deviation or the variance calculation. So the higher, just because you see a larger standard deviation, does not necessarily mean that there is more risk in a true sense. Scaling the standard deviations by the average will give you the true extent of the relationship, and it does hold here. Sure enough, small stocks have a higher return average historically. They have a higher coefficient of variation measure of risk than do large stocks, and those have a higher risk measure by coefficient of variation than bonds do. Notice, by the way, bonds are notably lower in pure risk than stocks of any kind. They just are. Lower, and of course, you get a lower expected return on them, too. You get a lower return historically, and your expectation of return is going to be lower as well. Now comes the big one. I'll turn this off. I'm going to kill the lights. Let's go back and now look at stocks. Now, the scatter plot, notice something. Oops. Let me kill this here. Clear the memory buffer. Turn that off. Okay, look at this. Individual stocks. Notice how they actually suck in terms of the risk-return relationship. That's that whole thing I've been telling you about. You don't get the benefits of the risk-return relationship in its pure form by just buying merely individual stocks, because they are, I'm going to bring something up here. This is a, I might have actually mentioned it before. It's a term from physics, and it's been understood for several hundred years, actually, mathematically, conceptually, and in very technical form. It's been understood in physics, especially in engineering, for a very, very long time. And we've understood it as part of especially finance and in general economics for quite some time now, too, for maybe more than half a century, I should say, that there is this physical phenomenon. It's true in mechanical physics. It's true in astrophysics, true in mechanical engineering. It's true in finance. It's a phenomenon where you have data that has two dimensions to it, okay? And you will find that when you are plotting data points, let's say you're plotting engine performance. Now, you look at all kinds of different car engines. You'll find that we'll plot on the horizontal axis horsepower against fuel efficiency. We'll do that one as just. You can get all kinds of horsepower with low fuel efficiency. And you'll get some cars that will have engines. That will have higher fuel efficiency with higher horsepower. But what you will see when you've plotted a lot of data is that none of the data gets past a certain point. We call this the envelope. We see it all over the universe. A lot of things we do. You have decided that you are going to be a beefcake. You decided that you are tired of getting sand kicked in your face at the beach. You were tired of people asking you if you wanted the children's menu at Denny's. Indeed, you wanted to have rippling muscles. You were going to change your name to Olaf and say, my name is Olaf, and ripple your muscles. Ripple, ripple. Okay? So you start exercising. Did you ever see the original movie Rocky? A lot of people did. I actually, when I was young, I saw the movie. I thought, I'm going to do that. I started talking like Rocky. Okay, Adrian. And I started actually exercising. I saw Rocky put 5 eggs into a glass and drink them raw. So I did. I actually did that. In airline terminology and accident investigations, they call it a debris field. That's what came out of my mouth, you know. And then I really did talk. Anyway. Okay, so you're exercising. You're developing muscle mass. Your body fat mass is going down as a percentage. Your muscle mass is increasing. Your weight that you can lift is increasing. But there's a point you can't get beyond. You'll never get beyond it. That's your envelope. And we see that in athletics all the time. Every performer, every athlete has an envelope of performance. A performance can't get beyond it. It just is never going to happen. And we see it in the performing arts, a level of skill beyond which the individual artist will never get, a piano player or whatever, or an oboe player, or a fine artist. You can move upward, but you can't get past a certain point. That's the envelope of performance, the performance envelope. It just is there. We see it all through physics, kinesiology, chemistry. You can get a certain chemistry. You can get a certain level of a reaction, but you, no matter what you do, no matter what catalyst you try to put into the equation, you can't get past that. In fact, we have a problem with that. He didn't know the discussion he was engaging in at the time, but he brought up, there was he wasn't an economist, but he was sort of like a pre-economist named Malthus several centuries ago, who pointed out that no matter how intensively we use the land, there was going to be a point, as we expand the population, we can increase our output of food. But there's a point at which we cannot increase the output of food anymore. And that would be a performance envelope of the environment. It looked like that. He speculated it had to look like that. He was describing a performance envelope for food production, actually for calorie production planet-wide. But he also pointed out that populations grow exponentially. All animals grow at an exponential rate. So what he pointed out was that there would someday be a breaking point, sort of like the four horsemen of the apocalypse, for any kind of system. And beyond that point, you would have starvation, wars, pestilence would take hold and back the population back off severely, only for us to do it again and again. He said that there would come a point where we would go through this, we would go into a part of history that would be very grim, because we would have to have tremendous wars to wipe out large numbers of people, and diseases that we would have diseases that would help along the path, and then we'd come back, and then we could move forward again. Interestingly. Okay. I'm trying to convince you that this is something that's not finance related. Look there. Do you see with individual stocks? Do you see the envelope? And then with the portfolios, it's even more evident. When you start talking about portfolios of securities, the corporate bonds, the world portfolio, the Standard & Poor's 500, mid-cap, small caps, there's an envelope sitting there in the data looking at us. We can't get a higher expected return for a given level of risk. There is a performance boundary. You see it? If I want this much volatility, if I want to hold my volatility to this, that's all the farther I will get. 20% will be about a 13% return. There's nothing you can do that will do better than that. You come up here, I want a 20% return. Well, I want 20% volatility. Nope, it's not there. It ain't there. It's past the envelope. I'll take 30%. Sorry, bucko, you can't do that. That's past the envelope. It's like these geniuses who stomp their feet and say, I want this. And the engineers just look and say, bitch, you can't have that. It's just not there. Now, eventually, with physical process, especially in engineering, what we can pull off is new technologies that will push the envelope. You ever heard that term, push the envelope? This is now you see what the. So I've asked these people who think they're smart, well, what does push the envelope mean? They talk about some white paper envelope they push across the. No, technologies changing can push an envelope. Okay, so we can push your envelope somewhat. You wanted to be that muscle man. You wanted to have balloon muscles, those giant biceps, and that big double-breasted man chest and all that. I know. I can see you want that. You can have it. We have performance-enhancing drugs. You take them long enough. Well, you'll get 5 gold medals, but just like Bruce Jenner, eventually they'll have down effects. Okay. But the point there is that we can push envelopes with new technologies. Later in your lives, well, actually, you're seeing it right now. We have an envelope of age. No matter how much you do, you won't go beyond a certain lifetime. We know that the envelope is there. But we also know that if we do some really weird technological tricks, we might be able to start pushing the envelope. So within your lifetime, we might be able to say the envelope isn't 115, 120 years. It might be 150, 160 years by tweaking the ends of the chromosomes, the part called the telomeres, or another trick. Maybe we can pull that off. But with stocks, you got nothing. You got nothing. There's not another technology there. This is it. And if you invest in individual stocks, you aren't even going to be near the envelope. See individual stocks, where they are? They're way down below the envelope. It's only when you get up here that you're on the envelope, and that means portfolio, diversified portfolio. I read just to bring this up, and I smell a rat in the woodpile, but a researcher, I think he was in Belgium, he sent me a note, a very nice note, just a few days ago. He said he had written a paper in which he was showing that, yeah, well-diversified portfolio, but our normal way of doing it is you contribute each stock in its weight in the world portfolio, in the overall market portfolio. And he had shown that actually, if you just buy stocks flat, 100 shares of each stock, you get a return that is actually slightly better than, or statistically it looked about the same. Now, my reaction was, first of all, well, that's kind of radical, and then I realized, okay, that's not anything, because honestly, in the world we have today, in this world right now, there is a cluster of maybe 200 companies that pretty much are the market portfolio, maybe 500. So in other words, the rest of the stocks in the economy, in the world economy, whatever you want to say, market economy, they really aren't contributing that much to begin with. So if you put them in there, all they're going and in there in the same proportion as the large stocks, all you're going to see is the same thing, the market portfolio, because those 200, 500 largest companies in the world are the world market, and everything else is just going to kind of reflect that anyway. But anyway, there is the risk-return relationship, the envelope. Notice you have a couple that kind of push on it. We are fascinated by those companies. They're not, you know, anything incredible. It's like that day, we know your envelope is 200 pounds. One day you pull 226 pounds. We're fascinated by that. You know, of course, you're walking around, you know, with pain in your legs, and you got a ripped half of your chest and all that. But still, you did it. So we're kind of curious about that. And so you see a lot of talk about these oddballs that show up just slightly above the envelope, individual stocks, that is. Now, that's something that I want to bring up, too, is that there are some securities that have virtually no unsystematic risk. They almost stand like diversified portfolio in themselves. Once in a while, we see one of those. In other words, the proportion of diversifiable, of non-diversifiable to diversifiable risk is surprisingly high. Then we see normal stocks. A normal stock will have quite a bit of diversifiable risk. In other words, it would be parked way down here. Your returns on that would be associated with quite a bit of stupid risk. Those are what we call typical stocks. And then there are eight, and what am I talking about for a typical stock? Maybe at least half of the risk, the total risk, is risk that you should not take. It's diversifiable. I mean, the book even showed you a couple of stocks like Microsoft. What was it, like 40% of its total price volatility is diversifiable risk. You could just get rid of it by putting it over. So you're not a hero for doing that. And then there are some stocks which are really odd. Well, not odd. They're just quite surprising in the sense that they have almost all of their risk is diversifiable. They might have 10% of the total price volatility is non-diversifiable risk. 90% of it is risk, just company peculiar, odd risk that you can shake out 90% of the price volatility. We run into those. I've run into a few of them. They had wild price swings, just incredible. I thought, well, obviously a lot of that's diversifiable risk. But then when I looked at the actual diversifiable risk, it was appalling. These stocks were actually incredibly tame stocks. Their betas were like 0.2, 0.3. Even though they had insane price volatility, most of that price volatility was because of the company itself. It wasn't anything to do with the system, the market. It was just oddities of the company that made investors jump in and jump out like crazy. So you get them all over the place. I think even the book shows you some of those kinds of stocks, or it points the same idea out to you somewhere in this chapter. Okay, taking all of this aside, last thing to point out about this envelope. The envelope, it looks slightly curved, slightly. Do you see how the envelope has a slight bit of a bow to it? It's not really enough for us to worry too much about. Now, I mean, in PhD level finance, you'll see dissertations written trying to figure out what the actual mathematical equation is. But the problem is, as far as huge, well-diversified portfolios, we don't have too many data points. It's like, are we really seeing something other than a straight line underneath this? Or is it just because we don't have more data points available to us? In other words, there are only so many incredibly well-diversified portfolios you could construct. So it might just be, and that's what we kind of suspect, that it's just that if we had more data points, they would kind of be giving us more of a true impression. This envelope is a straight line. Now, that leads us to the capital asset pricing model. Now, remember, a straight line is one of those things from your dark past in algebra classes. You might remember the slope-intercept form of a linear equation is y equals mx plus b. Do you remember that from somewhere in your dark past? There will be a slope, and there will be a y-intercept to it. So, in our way of describing this, we would have that the expected return to a portfolio, and I'll write an S for security, would be of the form y equals some slope times a return, and I'll put a little question mark over it, plus some base return you'd always get. In other words, whatever the slope is of this envelope, we'll work on that. It's not hard to figure out what it is. And its y-intercept would be a return that would be what you would get for no risk at all. You see that? It would hit the y-axis at no risk. What is the return that is associated with zero risk? Now, see if you know what that is. I've told you a number of times in this class. What return is riskless? You remember? I always hinted at it that we usually say, we don't know, it's a theoretical thing, but we always proxy it with the rate on a short-term T-bill. Do you remember the term that I use for a risk that, for a return that has no risk in it? You're going to hate yourself when I tell you. It's called the risk-free rate. That would have to be the y-intercept. The rate you would get for zero risk. And anything above that would be driven by the slope of the envelope line. And so we come to the famous capital asset pricing model, the CAPM. It's such a simple equation. It's just a linear equation that represents the risk of the envelope, the risk-return relationship on the envelope. Now, the way it works is this. The return you would expect from any security or portfolio, this is an expected return, remember that. It's not the actual return, it's the expected. We care about the future, not the past. Would be, now we write it kind of backwards, we write the y-intercept first. Instead of y equals mx plus b, we write b plus mx. So the y-intercept, what security gives you a return for no risk, that would be the risk-free rate, which we typically have always, it's a theoretical thing. It's the theoretical hit on the y-axis of the envelope. But we usually use the treasury bill rate, a short-term treasury bill rate. In more modern times, interestingly enough, I might have brought this up, it's become popular instead of using the T-bill, the return on a very short-term T-bill for a case of F, I've seen the use of a 10-year treasury note or treasury bond to pull it, or a 7-year note. And there's some reasons. I'll bring that up next week. Okay, plus. Now we need the slope of the line. The slope of the line is beta of the security or the portfolio. It's the measure of risk relative to the market portfolio times and it's called the expected premium of the market over the risk-free rate. And it is the return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. This is the premium for investing in the market portfolio instead of a risk-free instrument. So in other words, if the market's returning 15%, and the treasury bill rate is 2%, then your reward for taking risk is 13%. Because you can get 2% without taking any risk. But if you take the market, you get an extra 15 minus 2%. And we call this the expected premium of the market over the risk-free rate. A lot of times, you don't have to say it like that. We say the market premium. Remember, it actually is an expected rate. But you just say the market premium over risk-free. The market premium over risk-free. So in other words, this is your reward for getting the taking the market on instead of just being a coward and investing in treasuries. Beta tells you how much you are magnifying that risk or demagnifying it. Watch. Suppose right now, let's take a T-bill yield at 1.25%. And let's say that the expected return to the market portfolio right now is, let's say, 12%. So now we can find the expected return. Let's try one. Do you happen to remember what the return on what the beta of target was? I pulled up target. What was it? 0.68? Okay. We can find out what the expected return to that is. It would be 1.25% plus a beta, and the market expected return to the market portfolio is 12% minus 1.25%. That's our expected return to the stock in a well-diversified portfolio. Remember, this is all about well-diversified portfolios. So if I were to whack that out, I would have 1.25 plus 0.68 times, open parentheses, 12 minus 1.25, close the parentheses, 8.56%. That's my expected return to target. What was that? 8.56%. In a well-diversified portfolio, this would be the contribution of target. Notice that stocks that have betas below 1 demagnify the market premium. In other words, they dampen out the swings of the market. Stocks that would have betas above 1 would magnify that expected premium of market over risk-free. If I were to take a stock like, let me try something here real quick. I'm going to high beta stocks. Seriously? I'm so sick of advertisements in my face. Okay, we got someone who wants, 6 pages. I'm going to go 6 pages. Let's try that again. Stock. Let's try this. Betas. I can't remember the site. There's one where you can actually say, I want to look at stocks only with betas between this and this, and it'll show you. It's great for forming a portfolio. Yeah, it's Wikipedia, a bunch of dumbasses. I don't want the definition. I'm a damn professor. Lookup, stock beta lookup. Yeah, there we go. I wonder if, I don't think, does Yahoo still have it? Lookup beta. Oh, for heaven's sakes. I wanted to show you this anyway, and I should have tried to remember. Beta Morningstar. God, let me do it this way. Finance. Call out a company you think might have a high beta. What do you think? Does anyone come to mind that would be a fairly risky stock right now that you think would probably be risky? Chesapeake Energy. Let's see it. That should have. Well, very good. Someone give him a candy bar. It's got a 1.23 beta. Okay, so let's see what Chesapeake would do. Case of best for Chesapeake would be the 1.25% plus 1.23 times 12%. Minus 1.25%. Notice that for beta, you can actually use just the percentages. This is probably the only place in mathematics that you could actually, instead of turning them into decimals, you don't have to do that. So just notice again, do you see how in this case, the beta magnifies your expected premium over risk-free of the market? So if I were to pull this one out of my hat, I would say 1.25 plus 1.23 times, open parentheses, 12% less 1.25, close the parentheses, equals 14.47%. 14.47. Notice how the capital asset pricing model mathematically captures the relationship between non-diversifiable risk, beta, and the expected return to the security. It captures it perfectly. And again, there might be a little bit of curve to that envelope, but for all intents and purposes, the linear CAPM does the job very nicely. And remember, you're finding out what the return is going to be in a well-diversified portfolio. So that once you have formed, gotten the betas, you get your stocks, put your stocks together for your portfolio, you get the betas, and then you run the CAPM on each one, then add them up by their weights in your portfolio, by their how much market value they have in your portfolio, you got your expected return, the expected return to the whole portfolio, the true basis of financial planning. The one caution I will have, I give you, is now the Treasury bill rate is not the risk-free rate. It's sort of like our best real-life thing of it. Okay, so the other one is expected return to the market portfolio. There are a number of services that provide the best expert projections for it. I participate in one, a poll of 60 financial analysts around the world. And there are a bunch of them. You can go to all these different places. What is your services expected return to the market portfolio based upon your survey of your experts? And you always see them. Once in a while, you'll see something that's out of line with the rest of them. But for the most part, they're all within a few tenths of a percent of each other. Most of the time. So you go to one of those services. You go, just go to some Yahoo Finance, find out what the T-bill rate is right now, the annualized T-bill rate. You go to one of these services to get your expect a return to the market portfolio. And then you just run the numbers on the beta, on the betas. And you got yourself the basis of, you're seeing the pro stuff right now. That's how we do it. I mean, there are these really wild new age ways that I show in 349, FIL 349, but I don't even like those. Here it is. This is one of the end points right here. And if you take further finance courses, you're probably not going to, at least on the subject of risk and return, here is about the end point. Now, they'll show you a few other sort of like ripoffs of the CAPM. There's one called the Arbitrage Pricing Theory, APT, that has, instead of a single thing here, the beta times expected, it has sort of like several different betas that measure different types of risk and all of that. Hardly anyone believes that. The CAPM is so simple, so elegant, we almost all use it. But they'll show you that. But pretty much, this is one of the endpoints. And then we go back and we work out, figure out betas of portfolios, figuring out the expected returns to portfolios, the whole nine yards from here. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.